Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we have another great show for you this evening. We have Robert Schroeder, and he's going to be talking about solving the UFO enigma. There's going to be a little bit of science involved. I hope that doesn't scare you. He's a great guy. I had him on way long ago, and back when my shows were 1 hour. And speaking of that, I want to make something clear. When people sign up for my subscription, I say that you have access to the archives, and that's true. But the 2 hour shows only started at 1:27. I think it was Linda Moulton Howe was the first 2 hour show I had, so it only goes back to 127. I just wanted to make that disclaimer because I always forget to say that. And so all the shows prior to that were free shows and 1 hour shows. And to support the show for $2 a month, all you have to do is go to podcastufo.com, and it's right on the menu bar. If you can't help us out, we appreciate every listener. If you'd like to listen to the full shows, all you have to do is check out YouTube on Wednesday. You can watch them live on Wednesday evening at 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, or on our website, podcastufo.com. Playing both those times, and also there's a lot of people listen over at the Dark Matter Digital Network. Hello to you over there. I started the show. One of the reasons I started the show is because I'd been doing different podcasts for a long time. I still have one. That first one that I started was the Antique Auction Forum. It's still going, actually. I started that back in 2009. So not too many people interested in UFOs are all that interested in antiques, but you never know. So the real reason I'm bringing this up is I have a show coming up on that kind of has a cross interest, because I have Dan Curry on, and he was an Emmy Award. He won 7 Emmy Awards and 15 nominations for visual effects on Star Trek. And so he's going to be on my Antique Auction Forum podcast next week. He might be on YouTube. We're trying to work that out. But he's going to be talking about his collection of Star Wars, you know, behind the scenes memorabilia and stuff like that. So it might be something you're not interested in, but I'm definitely going to be bringing up the topic of UFOs. I'm going to do it. Okay. All right, that's it. I'm going to bring in my buddy Alejandro Rojas. Hello, Alejandro.
Hello. So are you a little nervous about bringing up UFOs with your antique buddies?
I might feel it out before I actually, you know, somehow test
the waters.
Just
go for it. You know what's surprising these days, I think, is that because of this Department of Defense news, people are feeling, it's surprising how many people know about it, first of all. And people are feeling pretty good about UFO stuff, I think, these days. They're feeling more comfortable discussing it.
I had a casting agent wrote me today about, they're looking for people for a show, and they say they're going to make it like an Anderson Cooper, you know, serious UFO Whoa. Show for the History Channel coming up.
Oh, that would be neat.
And so they're asking me to reach out to people for them.
The History Channel is trying a lot of stuff. They must have sent something out to production companies saying, hey, we want a UFO show, because I've gotten some calls, and it sounds like they're being approached from different angles with different ideas. So we'll see what comes of this. But it seems like they want another show and a couple other networks as well. So cross your fingers. I've talked to quite a few of these people myself, not just for, you know, programs and stuff they can cover, but possibly myself being on one of these. So we'll see.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, I want to say to the YouTube listeners out there, check out Alejandro now. I mean, you got like a studio thing going there.
You like it?
You got a background. You have light, everything. Wow.
I've got background and light. You know, I'm going to get some cooler logos to put up here. I think that'll be kind of neat. I was trying to do something different, you know. Everybody does green screen, which is kind of neat, but it's complicated. I got this other background that just didn't work out. And, you know, you got to get the distances and everything worked out. But, yeah, this is pretty cool, I think, for now. And I'm hoping to do more videos, because people who follow our Open Mind YouTube probably will notice we haven't posted anything in a while. So I'm going to try to do some more videos, and people love videos, you know.
I was doing green screen, as you know, and I started like floating, so I just couldn't stop it. All these weird things.
Well, like your background's cool.
Yeah, it's just a photographer's background. That's all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's maybe I'll be able to sell, you know, make some money.
Yeah, like selling. Was it QVC TV or something? Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking I've got some like stickers I was going to put. Like, here's Hackfort, that event that Mark and Ben.
Yeah.
But that might be too small.
Yeah.
But I'll have to charge
for
people.
99 cents.
Yeah. For $100, Podcast UFO can be behind Alejandro Rojas. Ain't going to be
we'll
cheap,
sign,
buddy.
We'll sign everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's happened in the UFO world?
Yeah, lots of cool stuff going on, in my humble opinion. I do want to plug, you know, Tyler Rogaway, the guy I interviewed this week, because he was great. He writes for a conventional, another person who, because of the DOD news, felt emboldened to be able to write about UFOs, something he has an interest in. And he started off and he said, you know, aerospace people, pilots, they all have an interest in UFOs. He says if they say they don't, they're lying. He knows this because he's a journalist that writes for defense, and he writes about Lockheed Martin, Skunk Works, all of this really cool stuff. And he has tackled a couple UFO stories recently, one of which was just hit the headlines. You and I have talked about this Arizona event, Arizona, the and New Mexico, where these pilots saw something. But he has an even much better one, which is where this flight from California to Oregon, where they had seen an object that was caught on radar. The control tower asked the pilots, hey, does anybody see this? Many, many pilots chimed in and said, yeah, we see it. We see it. You know, they described it as this bright object that was very large, as large as they are, which, of course, they're these large commercial airplanes. They felt that this is nothing small. This has got to be big, but it didn't have a transponder. So that was weird. They didn't know what it was. It was moving at a speed equal to theirs. At least it was at a, you know, length that was at least as large as theirs. Nobody said they could make out any wings or anything. These were flights that were landing in Portland. As soon as these flights landed, F-15s were scrambled, and the FT-15s couldn't find anything. The whatever it was gone by the time that these F-15 fighters got there. So a great case. He did some great FOIA work. He worked with the FAA to get the audio. So it's an incredible case. It's a really, really good case. So you can find this on the website called it's The Drive, and the section he writes for, which is the defense section, is called The War Zone. And Tyler Rogaway is his name. You can find him on Twitter, too. But some really good stuff. I had him on my podcast last time, but those are some great stories out there.
Yeah, started listening to the podcast. I think I fell asleep. It has nothing to do with you. It was just late at night. But it sounded like it was really good.
It was a lot of fun.
He sounded enthusiastic as well. So, and
he
Yeah, I really like talking to people like outside of, not to offend anyone at all, but kind of like outside of the UFO realm that have had some type of experience. They're always interesting stories and an interesting perspective.
You know? Yeah, I agree. I agree with you 100%. And it's important, I think, because if we're going to reach broader audiences and enlist people with expertise who can help, and the type of expertise that Rogaway has, being very familiar with top secret aircraft or our defense capabilities, that's expertise which is vital. And we talked about why he has been reticent to, you know, discuss or do anything with his UFO interests, because of the nature of the field. You know, there's a lot of goofballs out there. We're silly goofballs.
Yeah, that's right. We're harmless.
Which is, I think. Yeah, we're the harmless type of goofball.
Yeah. Anything else happening?
Yeah, there's other stuff that's kind of cool. This is, I think, a very cool story. The story I posted was from Popular Mechanics. You can find this on the front page of openminds.tv. But there are other stories out there. And this is the idea that they think they might have discovered life on Venus. So this is a really, this is a really neat story. This ad popped up, but I got some details here. But essentially, of course, they've thought that Venus is too hot and inhospitable to have life. But they've noticed these dark clouds in Venus's atmosphere, and they think that these might be light-absorbing bacteria. So it would kind of be like the ocean, where we have these blooms of bacteria and a similar thing, but in their atmosphere in Venus, that, you know, there may be this bacteria living there. So an amazing discovery if they do find out that's what it is. Wouldn't but it's really cool that, yeah, they're taking this really seriously, that this could be.
Isn't that something?
Maybe they'll
Mm-hmm. So all these contactees that were saying they were, you know, in touch with the Venusians, all these, you know?
Yeah.
They were right.
Who knows? Maybe these bacteria have consciousness, and they even can use telepathy. Who knows?
Yeah.
Sure, we'll find out over time. You know, we're always finding out the universe is much stranger than we expect. But maybe they'll be watching these plumes, and they'll see some kind of large creature come floating up in the clouds and eating the bacteria. Who knows?
Well, but wouldn't that be ironic, though? A planet that. It has been stated many, many times over the years that there's no way there could be life there. Wouldn't that be ironic if life was found there first?
No kidding, especially with all of the missions and everything, all the focus on Mars.
Yeah.
It would be shocking. It would be really cool if that did happen.
Yeah.
Let's see. There was another couple of things. Tom DeLonge has got his Secret Machines Book 2 coming out. Of course, it's fictionalized. But it's supposed to be based on real stuff. That's kind of interesting. But this is really cool. The Mint in Winnipeg is the Canadian Mint. They are posting a Manitoba UFO encounter coin. They actually already made it, and I guess it's a hit. It's a different kind of shape, and it glows in the dark. But it is in commemoration of the sighting that took place. And Chris Rutkowski, you know, the UFO researcher in Canada, he's been doing some news pieces, so we have some of those. We posted the extended version of an interview with him about this with CTV, Canadian Television News. And so it's kind of cool. This was an event that occurred in the 70s. I can't remember exactly which year. Sorry for that. But essentially, this is a guy who came across a craft and it actually burnt him. He got too close, and he said it took off and it burnt these marks across his chest. But
So they're
they're commemorating this UFO encounter with this coin, a really cool coin. I was like, I'm gonna get it. It's a $20 coin, but you know, even though they put that monetary value, they charge more for them. I wasn't aware of that, so I was really happy to spend my $20, and it turned out it's actually $140 for the coin. So I'm not sure if I can make that much of an investment yet. My boss did, or John Rayo, the owner of OpenMinds.tv. So I'm excited to get a look at his coin once he gets it. I guess they're going to be shipped out in June, but really cool.
I always think of that as the Falcon Lake incident, and that was back in 1967, by the way.
Yeah, you're right. And you know what? I could be, and this has happened before, believe it or not, I could be completely wrong in the sighting that they want to
commemorate. No, that would be the same sighting, because the guy had the burn marks on him. That's Falcon Lake, but it happened in Manitoba.
Yeah, it is Falcon Lake. Yeah, you're right, 67. So that is the one that they're commemorating.
Yeah, that is.
So cool stuff.
Yeah, that was quite an incident. Mm-hmm. I would love to do a show on that sometime if there's like a researcher that wrote a book. I don't know. I haven't even looked into it, but that would be good to do a show.
Well, you know
what?
You'll have to, you know, people can go to openminds.tv right now, and on the front page in our headlines, you'll see the interview with Chris Rutkowski. He might be the person to talk to about that case.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's great. I mean, he's a journalist. He's very credible and grounded in his research, so I'm a big fan of his. But if you go to articles and then you go to look at the daily UFO headlines, you'll see the link for the actual coin story, where you'll be able to also find the link to purchase your own should you wish to do so.
Okay, so is that it for news today?
That's it. Yeah, unless you want some more, I'm sure I can come up with something. There's always lots of exciting stuff going on.
I think it's time to bring on the guest, but I really appreciate it, Alejandro, and we'll be talking to you next week as always.
Yep, you've got a great guest to go to, so you better get to it. And thank you very much. We'll talk to you next week.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
You too. See ya.
All right, our guest, Robert Schroeder, like I said, he was on many years ago at the beginning of the podcast. His book is called Solving the UFO Enigma, How Modern Physics is Revealing the Technology of UFOs. He's recently retired. Well, he's been retired a while after 26 years from Hewlett-Packard, where he was involved in operations and product management. He has degrees in math from Rutgers and University and in aerospace engineering. And anyway, we are going to be talking now to Robert. Welcome to the show again, Robert.
Hi, Martin. Thank you for having me on the show again.
Yeah. Yes. Last time it was face-to-face in my office when I was down in Massachusetts. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah. I sure do.
Yeah.
Where was it?
Woburn.
By the mall. Woburn. Yeah, yep. That was it. Right.
Woburn, as they say there, the locals.
Yeah. I'm from New Jersey, so yeah. Originally, yeah.
Yeah. And, I believe I hear a phone ringing. Perhaps that's okay.
You're right.
It'll stop ringing.
Sorry
eventually.
About that.
Yeah, yeah. That's okay. For the person that doesn't know your background, I know you have other science or engineers in your family, but can you kind of give a background? And I remember you telling me you had a sighting when you were young, a real unique sighting, if I remember right. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because I would like to talk about that a little too. And but first, let me give you a little bit of my background. I come from New Jersey, as I just mentioned, and I grew up in Teaneck, New Jersey, which is a little town. Well, not that little. It's physically, it's not too big, but population-wise, it has about 40,000-50,000 people. So compared to the town I live in now, which is physically much bigger, but has a much smaller population. But we were a suburb of New York City. And so I grew up there in the 50s and 60s. And probably sometime in the 80s, I came up to this part of the country to work for a computer company. Originally, it was Digital Equipment Corporation, which I'm sure many of the local people here remember. But eventually, Digital was swallowed by Hewlett-Packard. So at the end of the day, I ended up retiring from Hewlett-Packard after 26, 27 years. And that was a great company to work for, one of the best reasons to work for Hewlett-Packard. I had trips out to California.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In the middle of the winter. and for those of us in Massachusetts, you can really appreciate that, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, I come from a family of scientists and engineers. My dad was a chemist, and he graduated from MIT, so I have that kind of a background. I have a degree in math from Rutgers. My daughter works now down in the D.C. area, and she's a structural engineer, you know, probably a bit unusual for a woman, mm-hmm. But that's what she does. And my wife is a math teacher. I met a high school math teacher. I met her in abstract algebra at Rutgers. So if that gives you an idea of who I am, you know. And I love science. Even though I ended up in the business world, I worked, you know, for a computer company there. And I was actually in finance and operations and product management. My heart was always with science. And physics in particular, I just love it. You know, I'm the kind of guy that I go to bookstores and I live here in Massachusetts, and I'll go to the Harvard Coop. They're big bookstore there. You know about that,
yep.
Martin?
Yep.
Yeah, and it's gigantic, and there are just literally thousands of books on science and stuff. And my wife gets a little upset, but I could spend the entire day there, you know, and looking through the books. You'll only let me buy so many per trip, you know, otherwise would be buried, you know. You sent me an email before the show that one of your listeners, I think his name was Tom, had asked a couple of questions, and how did I end up with an interest in physics and stuff, even though I worked in the business world. Well, actually, I originally wanted to work for NASA, but by the time I graduated from college in 1972, at that time, there was a lot of budgetary problems, and they were cutting back on the NASA budget. So I ended up switching to a business major. I ended up getting an MBA, and so I stayed in Rutgers for two more years. And that worked out great because I did okay, nice retirement and all that stuff. But I missed science, and all through the years, when time allowed, I would read on physics and stuff like that. And just to give you an idea of what I do when I read about physics, I love the general interest books. I definitely enjoy those. But I also am interested in the math and physics. So I've been, for the last year and a half, I've been studying the math of general relativity, tensor math, and all that stuff. And I've also kind of looked at quantum mechanics. I derived Schrodinger's equation, which is one of the key equations of general relativity. But in fact, I forgot to mention, I wrote a book, Solving the UFO Enigma, How Modern Physics is Revealing the Technology of UFOs. And in that book, for anybody who's interested, they can see how I derived the key wave equation of quantum mechanics. And it's kind of fun. Don't be afraid of it. I tell people, even if you don't have a math background, you can figure it out. In the back of the book, I show basic calculus, how to do it. I show vector calculus and things like that too. So that's one thing I really believe in, that people should not be afraid of the math and the physics. In the back of the book, in Appendix A, I don't know if you... Oh, Martin is showing it on the video here. You can kind of see it. In Appendix... Oh, yeah, you're looking at the Schrodinger equation derivation there. And it's not as bad as you might think. It takes a little bit of... you've got to kind of go through the... If you don't have a background in math, you want to go to the Appendix A and look at that, and then you can flip back to the Schrodinger equation. I hope that gives people an idea of where I come from and my background. I love science, and I have so much fun. Oh, by the way, another thing I forgot to mention. After I retired, I started doing substitute teaching at a middle school and high schools and stuff. And I have so much fun with the kids. I try to inspire them to get into math and science, and for a very good reason, I believe, because... many people may not be aware of this, but only about 6 or 7% of American college students go into engineering, and engineering and science. In contrast, in China, which is certainly one of our big competitors today, it's something like 40%. Huh. Isn't that incredible?
That's amazing.
It's 6-7 times greater, you know. Wow. And so if we don't watch out, we're going to lose our shirts, you know. Mm-hmm. And technology is so, so critical.
But you think of the population of China compared to the U.S., and then you do the math, how many people that is compared, never mind percentage, but the amount of people. And you're going to get some real smart people in there. You know, it's just bound to happen statistically.
Yep, I totally agree. Mm. We have really got to be kind of proactive about this. And but anyway, that's so when I'm in middle school and the high school, I love inspiring the kids and telling them about, you know, special relativity, general relativity, and stuff like that. And I've come up with some kind of simple ways to show them how it works, so they can actually see how the curvature of space-time creates what we call gravity. And then I do another example that shows that anybody can come up with the equations of special relativity. If you know the Pythagorean theorem, you can do it on your own, and it's that easy, you know. And people are unnecessarily afraid of math and science, and they shouldn't be. So I want to also mention about the UFO sighting that I had.
Yeah.
This was way back, way back. It was November 1957, and for people who have really followed the UFO experience over the years here, they will be aware that 1957 was one of those times when there was a gigantic UFO wave around the world, but particularly in the United States. And at the time, I was only about 10 years old, and of course I don't think I was reading the papers back then. I think I was out playing baseball, but one day in 1957, but I did love science even then as a kid. My dad used to buy us chemistry sets and things like that. And my grandfather was an engineer. So because of that kind of history and background, it's just sort of in my blood, you know. And so one day, about 5 o'clock in the afternoon in November, so the sun was already beginning to go down, but you could still see it. It was still bright daylight. And I looked up in the sky, and we lived about 2 or 3 miles west of New York City, Manhattan, the George Washington Bridge, mm-hmm. if for people that know that part of the country. So I looked up, and I looked at the peak of the roof of our house. We had a big two-story house. I come from a big family, so we needed a big house. I have 5 brothers and sisters. I know. what happened was I was out there, and I don't know why I was out there, but I used to love to look up at this, the Boeing 707 was just coming out. And so you could see these jets going across the sky, and I used to love to go up there and go out and look at them. And I looked up, and I saw this cylindrical-shaped object coming over the roof of our house. But it was way up there, probably about 5,000 feet, and it was heading straight toward New York City. And it was exactly the shape of a cigarette. That's the best way I can describe it. Mm-hmm. And it was golden color. And I'm looking at this thing and I'm thinking, this is really weird, because Boeing 707s had tapered front and back. The nose was tapered and the tail was tapered, and you could see the wings usually. Now, of course, anybody in a clear, it was a perfectly clear blue sky, and I've noticed sometimes when a plane tilts its wings a certain way, you can see the fuselage, but you can't really see the wings. You know they're there, but, you know, you don't really see them. And so I thought, well, maybe that's what it is. And maybe it's just an optical illusion about the blunt front and the blunt back. I mean, when I say shaped like a cigarette, I mean exactly like a cigarette. And then as it continued, it's a majestic, that's the only way I can describe it, a majestic movement across the sky heading east toward New York City. And as I mentioned, we were about 2 or 3 miles west of Manhattan. I noticed there was a round object following in tandem behind this thing. And it was maybe one length of the cigarette behind it. And the cigarette, by the way, was long axis was pointing toward New York, and it was going in the direction of travel. they were both moving along together, and the round object was no wider than the narrow width of the longer cylinder. And so I was amazed. I could not believe what I was seeing. And here's this thing, and it's and then it finally headed toward the trees at the other end of our yard. And at that point, I said, oh, my gosh, I got to tell my brothers and sisters. So I ran inside to get them. And I got one of my brothers to come out, and he took a look, and he saw it just as it disappeared. But it was really strange. But now I got to tell you the connection to the UFO phenomenon. It was November 1957, and anybody who's studied the UFO phenomenon over the years knows that in early November, there was a big UFO case down in Levelland, Texas. Does that ring a bell?
It was to me. No.
Oh, it doesn't.
I'm sorry. I should have known of that one, but I just can't recall it.
No problem. Well, briefly, what happened down there, and Dr. J. Allen Hynek investigated. These objects came down. There was about 7 or 8 sightings around this town, and people's trucks were being stopped, cars being stopped, when these egg-shaped objects would land on the road, couple hundred feet in front of a car, and the car's engine would stop, a very typical characteristic of UFO close encounters. And as Dr. Hynek points out many times in his books, so it's very interesting that I saw this thing in November too. I think that's significant. And so anyway, years later, as a teenager, I took a book out of the Teaneck Public Library by Donald Kehoe, Major Donald Kehoe, And again, many people with a background in the UFO field know that Donald Kehoe was one of the guys that even though he was an Air Force guy, I think, was he Project Blue Book? I can't remember.
No, he was the first.
Yeah.
Lee Spiegel and I were just talking about him last night. He was basically the first government whistleblower on UFOs.
Oh, okay.
He was a former Air Force.
And, well, one of his books that I was reading sometime in the 1960s, it talked about this sighting over in France where this guy was walking his dog early in the morning, and he looked up in the sky, and he saw this gigantic cylinder, and it was like 2 a.m. in the morning or something, and he said it was like a metallic cylinder. It was tilted at a 45-degree angle. And as he watched it, he was wondering what the heck it was. He said this thing, he compared it to the clouds, and he kind of had an idea of how big the clouds were. And he said this thing easily had to be a half mile long. And so now I'm really interested as I read this story, because it sounded like the cylinder that I saw. And he described it as blunt on the ends and looking pretty much like a cigarette. And then here's the key to the whole thing. He said, on the bottom end of this thing, suddenly saw a flash of light, and a disc-shaped object came out, swirled around the cylinder a couple times, shot off in one direction of the compass. A second one came out, shot off in another direction, until 6 or 7 had come out and disappeared.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I realized what I had seen back in 1957 was one of these typical motherships, and that was just one of the UFOs, which must be what I guess you could call scout ships, that must be stacked up like plates on the inside of the mothership, you know. And I finally realized that's what it was. And that revelation really excited me, because I suddenly realized there was something to this phenomenon. This was something real. And so, over the years, as time permitted, I've been studying the UFO phenomenon, and of course my love of science too. I've tried to apply many times over the years. I kept wondering if different ideas could explain it. You've probably heard of the Alcubierre warp drive, Miguel Alcubierre, and I looked at that back in the 90s. Before that, there was that guy out in California, and I forget his name, Kip Thorne, the physicist, Kip Thorne. And he discussed the idea of wormholes and the idea of having negative energy to hold the wormhole open that would allow craft to travel between the stars. And so there were a number of these ideas floating around, but I never was totally sure of them. And eventually Miguel Alcubierre came out and said that his idea probably wouldn't work because the energy requirements were way too great. And Kip Thorne pointed out that the problem with the wormhole idea is that the idea of negative energy and a wormhole, trying to get a wormhole to go to, you can't direct the wormhole. You basically have to find one and then go into it. And the dangers are tremendous. I just suddenly realized, Martin, I've kind of taken off here without, you're the host.
This is all interesting. By the way, I have a question involving Ray Stanford coming up here in a second that was sent to me.
Okay.
And he just emailed me to correct me, and I looked it up at the same time. Kehoe was actually a Marine major. He was a aviator, too.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
And I was the one that said he was Air Force, so that was wrong. So here's a question with Ray. And by the way, later on we'll take calls. Anyone wants to call in, we will be taking calls right after, let's see, about a half hour from now. Okay, so this person wanted to know, have you ever spoken with Ray Stanford regarding propulsion ideas? Ray seems to have some very complex understanding or theories regarding propulsion. It would be neat to see how both ideas compare. Have you and Ray ever discussed this?
Before the show, I knew that question was going to be coming, and I only had about 10 or 15 minutes, but I quickly looked up on the internet, and I couldn't find much on Ray Stanford, and I couldn't find much about his theories. In fact, actually nothing. So I don't really know. I've definitely heard of him. I've heard him mentioned a few other times. I just haven't been able to find out much about his ideas.
Place that I can think of, and Ray may call in. He's called in a number of times. But the only place I can think that it's published would be in Chris Lambright's book, X Descending. His propulsion theory is played out very well in that, with images and everything. It's very interesting. And, Ray may call in later, in the half hour. But we have to talk about your theories, how you came up with it. And I remember I was kind of baffled, and you didn't go too sciencey, but you had to get a little bit into math and a little bit on how things work. We can start at the beginning or anywhere.
Go ahead. Okay.
Yeah.
That sounds great, Martin. And so the first thing I want to address is the UFO evidence. And I know a lot of people are skeptical about UFOs, but they really shouldn't be.
I don't think the ones that listen to this show, I don't believe they are. I believe there are some.
Yeah.
For the most part, I have people that are interested. We have a lot of people that are very good, healthy skeptics, but still are interested like you were all the years.
Yes, and I, you may have heard of Skeptical Inquirer.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Robert Schaefer.
Yeah.
And I actually saw him down in Arizona at the International UFO Congress, and I tried to get him to come over to my table, but I couldn't get him to come over. It was too bad. I always want those guys to get a fair hearing, so I don't really have any problem with skeptics. My attitude is that, now that Kepler, the Kepler telescope, Kepler's going up. That's the new one.
No, Kepler's the one that found the
Kepler's
planets
up there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, James Webb is the one that...
The James Webb.
Yeah, that's going
it.
Up.
Thank you, Martin. Yep. The James Webb is going up, I think, this year. But anyway, the Kepler and some other methods that they've been using, they've found about 4,000 extra solar planets out there, and I think they even found one, the TRAPPIST system, TRAPPIST, that has like 7 or 8 planets, many of them Earth-sized, and they think 2 or 3 appear to be in the habitable zone of the TRAPPIST system. I don't know how many people have heard about that, but the fact that the methods that they're using now are kind of biasing the data toward planets that are closer to their parent star. And for example, the TRAPPIST system is a dwarf star, a red dwarf, and so those planets are relatively close. And of course, the reason for that is they, what they're looking for is when the planet eclipses the star and there's a slight change in the light, then they know that the planet is there. Or there's a wobble in the star's orbit because of the planets tugging it. And so these are the different things. But of course, a planet that's closer to its parent star is going to create more of a wobble. And so the methods that they're using right now are not really designed to find solar systems like ours, where the planets are spread out and it's a G star, and of course, 99% of the stars out there, the planets going around them won't be in directly in our plane so that we can see the planets against that star. It's only about 1% that are happen to be eclipsing their stars that are at the right angle, the orbits of their planets. And So the reason I mention that is because the fact that just by these relatively primitive methods, they've already found 4,000 planets in a decade or two, tells you that they are just everywhere. And so, and before this, they really didn't know. It was pure speculation, the Drake equation. And so now they know. And the odds are that there are just literally billions, trillions of planets out there. And so I think the possibility of other Earths with intelligent life are just phenomenal. You know, I think they're absolutely overwhelming. And so anyway, so what I want to get to is the next question is, if there is life out there, have some of these more advanced civilizations than ours, have they been able to figure out how to get to planet Earth? And I think they have. And the reason I say that is because of the UFO evidence, not just my sighting, but sightings by thousands and thousands of people, by very credible witnesses like airline pilots, professors and things like that, people like that. And so I want to point out the evidence from the accumulated evidence we have of UFOs and their characteristics, because that's critical. So one of the things that's really interesting about UFOs is their rapid accelerations. This has been reported time and time again. I remember there was I think it was General Mills. I know they're a cereal company, but they operate some atmospheric research labs too, and they were doing some work down, I think, in New Mexico or someplace like that, and they had some balloons up there that they were observing through a theodolite, one day they saw a UFO circling one of their balloons, and they were watching it, and they could see it clearly, and they said it was a typical disc-shaped UFO. And then to their amazement, the thing took off, they estimated, because they were able to track it, at over 100 Gs, 100 times the force of gravity, the acceleration. This is unbelievable. And so the best that a human pilot can do is about 10 Gs in our jet fighters. And even then, it takes a G suit and special training and stuff. And that's about the best they can do. So that's an important characteristic of UFOs, this phenomenal acceleration. And we have to pay attention to these characteristics if we're going to understand their technology. And so that's one thing that's very important. Now, in order for an object, any kind of object, to accelerate fast, it has to overcome inertia, and inertia is nothing more than the resistance to acceleration. And there's a number of theories out there on where inertia comes from, but one of the guys that way back many years ago, back at the in the turn of the previous century, around 1900 or sometime in that era, an Austrian physicist by the name of Ernst Mach came up with Mach's principle. And his idea was that inertia is due to the mass of the entire universe, so pulling on any particular object when it tries to accelerate. And so he meant, when you look up at the sky at night, all those stars out there, all those galaxies and everything like that, billions and billions of light years away, are all tugging on whatever object it is in our vicinity that tries to accelerate, which is kind of an amazing theory. Einstein wanted to incorporate Mach's principle into his general theory of relativity, and he wasn't really sure whether he did or not. But anyway, so there's a number of people that have looked at this over the years, but the key thing I'm really trying to get at is that inertia, the greater the mass of an object, the greater the inertia, so the harder it is to accelerate. And this is very important to what we're going to get to later. And so somehow, and now, how much do these UFOs weigh? Well, Ted Phillips of MUFON, who used to work for Dr. J. Allen Hynek, actually went out and did a multi-year study on this, and he examined landing sites where UFOs had come down and looked at the indentations in the ground. I think there was one in France where it landed on railroad ties and left deep indentations in the railroad ties. And so he concluded that these objects, and he said, in the witnesses reported that the object came down and then very gently settled down. So the indentations don't appear to be from momentum, the object coming in fast and leaving a bigger indentation. So they appear to be just from the weight of the UFO itself after it turned off its whatever engines it has. And but he ended up coming up with a figure between 10 and 30 tons, 10 tons to 30 tons for the typical disc shape and egg-shaped and stuff wow. like that. Yes, you got it, Martin. It's this is...
And, you know, just getting... you do hear of impressions that are very deep on these uh-huh. landings. Like, for instance, the egg-shaped one at Socorro left, you know, really dig, you know, deep marks in the ground.
That's right, that's right. And Dr. J. Allen Hynek examined that landing site. So that was a very interesting one, because a police officer is generally going to be very credible. And I think there was possibly other witnesses who observed the thing at a distance. And but anyway, the reason I mention this is because somehow these UFOs, which appear to be in the 10 to 30 ton range, have phenomenal acceleration, which tells you that something really interesting is going on here, and for them to accelerate an object with great mass like that. You can think of like a cannonball. It takes tremendous force to shoot a cannonball, and you can actually see the cannonball, you know, as it travels. If you're at a particular angle, you can see it. But a rifle bullet, which has very little mass, when you shoot it out of a rifle, you can't see it. It's just so fast, you know. Mm-hmm. And it can accelerate a lot faster than a cannonball. And I've actually seen this. This is something it amazed me. I was in Vietnam back in 67, 68, and in the U.S. Army. And the battleship New Jersey, the state from where I come from, and was shooting at targets beyond where we were. We could hear the noise of the shells, the ones that had already passed us, because they're going pretty fast. But we happened to be looking up, and we saw these silver flashes in the sky, and I realized we were looking at the shells being lobbed by the New Jersey. So that tells you an object with a lot of mass can't go very fast, but it does carry a lot of punch because of its mass.
Right.
And of course the explosives. But anyway, that's just an example of what I mean by inertia and mass, the relationship there. So that's one of the other important characteristics. And then another very important characteristic of UFOs is their ability to levitate, and that's very interesting too. And typically levitate without making too much noise, although sometimes they hear a humming or generator noise. So I'd have to say that they do make some noise.
Some of them do, but a lot of times you do hear of the silence. That's the one you hear almost more often.
Yes, that's exactly correct, and I find that pretty amazing too.
Me too.
But then another characteristic which I really find interesting is that these a number of people over the years, pilots, have seen these UFOs become partially transparent and then totally disappear. And one of the best cases was Captain Charles Dubac, Air France, and I don't remember the date, maybe 1994, something like that, but he was approaching Paris in a Boeing 747, and he observed about a 1,000-foot diameter red disc about 20 miles ahead of him, and this red disc, he said it was picked up on their airborne radar as well as two ground radars, a military and civilian. And as they watched this object, it became partially transparent, and then they finally could see straight through it, and it finally totally disappeared. But it amazing. And then another guy up in Canada, and this was more recent, I think maybe 2014, 2015, observed a cylindrical-shaped UFO that was below him as he was coming in for a landing, and he saw it moving above this highway. And then as the UFO maybe apparently, for some reason, it suddenly became partially transparent and then totally disappeared right in front of his eyes. And he said the weird thing was he could see the road right through the object, but still see the outline of the object, and then it disappeared. There's a number of other cases. There was a guy, I can't remember his name, Chichester, Francis Chichester. You've probably never heard of him. He was one of the pioneers in aviation pioneer, and way back in, I believe, the 1920s, way back in the 1920s, you know what, the wind is blowing here, and I heard this noise by the door, but this guy, he was flying what's called a gypsy moth aircraft, which is a biplane, so this wasn't exactly fast, but he saw and those days they didn't call them UFOs in the 1920s, he observed this disc-shaped object with a cupola on the top, and he said what amazed him was, as he was watching it, he said it was maybe a mile out ahead of him, and as he's approaching it, and it was off to one side a little bit, he said the thing became partially transparent, and then it totally disappeared. And then where the object had been, a cloud formed in exactly the shape of the UFO. And then it dissipated in the breeze. Yeah. But then as he looked over on the right, he saw another flash of light, and the object reappeared over there. He said it seemed like it was splitting the sky and reappearing. And it moved, he said, maybe a mile off to one side. And And he was amazed. And it dawned on me when I read the story that gypsy moths, in those days, the planes couldn't fly too high. So they were, and he was not at a great altitude. I don't know his exact altitude, but I know he wasn't way up 40,000 feet or anything. I realized that at that height of the atmosphere, there would be a lot of moisture, because lower down you are, the more moisture. That's part of the reason jets, when they fly way up high, they get away from a lot of the turbulence and storm clouds and stuff in the lower atmosphere. That's why they fly up there, and it's thinner and they can go faster. And of course, where the atmosphere is moist, if you create a sudden vacuum, you end up with a cloud. That's how clouds form. As they go up to the lower pressure, higher up in the in the sky, that's why clouds form up there. It ends up creating it, a cloud. So that made me realize that this something. So that was the third case, but there's a number of others as well. But I just mentioned those three for our purposes here. And there's a few other characteristics of UFOs, like they have one very important one is that they're often seen to rotate, and that's very important as well. And another characteristic is they seem to glow. They often see a glow around UFOs, and that's of interest too.
That's what I actually, when I had my sighting, it had like a bluish glow over it. You know, it's
okay.
It was like twilight, like 8 o'clock in the evening. So it wasn't quite dark, and it went over me. There were no lights on it, but it was sort of like a silvery looking disc, but it had a hue of blue, like a light blue glow over the whole thing.
Oh, wow. And what year do you remember, Martin?
2006.
Oh, wow.
And that was Monterey area, California. The Carmel Valley. Yeah.
Oh, you were lucky to be out there. Yeah. I love California. By the way, when was that Chicago O'Hare sighting?
I want to say it was
2008 or 7?
I was 7, 2007. I think it was 2007. Gate C-17, I remember that. I will look as we're talking. That case, but that left a circle in the cloud.
Yes, punched a hole.
Yep.
Yeah. And
I think
the reason I asked.
Yeah. 2006, actually, as well.
See, there you go. Yeah. And that's what I was looking for. And you see, this is one of the things that people who are researching UFOs need to examine. The fact that a lot of these UFO sightings, there's connections. They occur at the same in the same year, same month, same season and stuff. So in other words, 57, you saw a slew of sightings. 59, there were a whole bunch. In the early 60s, there was a whole bunch. There were these waves at different times. And see how I quickly connected your sighting to the one up at O'Hare. This is the kind of stuff we people who look at the UFO phenomenon need to pay attention to, because that corroborates, it tends to confirm your sighting, because these things were being seen elsewhere. So now I think I'll jump right into the physics, because yes, I've kind of given the background we need. So here it is. Because I suddenly realized we only have till 10 o'clock.
Yeah, and then we're going to be taking calls too, so.
So I better go fast.
No, that's okay. Yeah.
People may be aware, the two pillars of modern physics are quantum mechanics and general relativity. And general relativity deals with the world of the very large, planets, stars, solar systems, galaxies, the universe as a whole. And quantum mechanics deals with the world of the very small, subatomic particles, atoms, things like that, quarks and protons, neutrons, electrons, and things. And and now it turns out that modern science, one of the big things in modern science has been to come up with a theory that unites all of the theories that are out there. And and it's basically called the TOE, T-O-E, theory of everything, right. And, and the big toe, so it's easy to remember. And but anyway, so general relativity came out in 1915, and then the quantum theory, Max Planck came out with the with his ideas on the quanta back then, and he and Einstein worked on that. And then by the mid-1920s, they had come up with all the basic rules and formulas of quantum mechanics, and then they later on they refined that much more in the years after that. But anyway, one of the big things, kind of the holy grail of modern physics, has been to try to unite the quantum theory with general relativity. And the key thing that's going on, and I do need to kind of do a mention a little bit of physics here, which is very important. We do need to know the quantum area of physics, the structure of matter, and the forces that act on matter. Basically, everything is made up of either matter particles or force particles acting on the stage of space-time, interacting on the stage of space-time. And that's it. That's the whole universe. We have space-time. We have matter particles. We have force particles. And it gets easier than that. It turns out that there really are only a few primary matter particles. There are quarks and there are leptons, and then there and that's it. Those are the two basic families of matter particles, and the quarks make up the protons and neutrons and mesons and particles like that. But most people are aware of protons and neutrons in an atom, and leptons include like an electron and neutrinos. And that's it. There's only really a few basic matter particles in the universe. That's it. But they combine in many, many different ways. And I won't go into too much detail on that because I don't want to confuse the listenership. And it's not all that critical. There's only really two types of quarks, an up quark and a down quark, that make up 99% of all the matter in the universe. And there's a few other types of quarks out there, but they are higher energy versions of the two basic ones. And so there's an up quark, a down quark, an electron, and neutrinos. And that's all there is to the four fundamental basic matter particles that make up everything. And so those are the matter particles, and on the force particles, again, there's only four. Four types of force particles. There's four basic types of forces. There's the strong nuclear force, which acts only with inside the nucleus, and it holds the nuclei together. And there's the weak nuclear force, which is responsible for radioactivity. And I'm going to be done with this real quick. I'm sorry I have to go into this detail, but it's important to the overall thing. And then there is electromagnetism, which everybody is familiar with. Photons carry the electromagnetic force. And then there's gravity, which we are all very familiar with, because when we have to get up in the morning to go to work, we all fight gravity until our first cup of coffee. And those are the four fundamental forces of nature. There is a fifth, a background field called the Higgs field, but I'll get to that in a second. The strong nuclear force consists of gluons that are exchange this strong nuclear force. The weak nuclear force is W plus W minus Z neutral. Electromagnetism is carried by the photon, and gravity. And here's where we're getting into important stuff. They've never seen this particle, but it's called the graviton, and that's the particle that is believed to carry the gravity force. So. So the interesting thing is, in physics, what they want to do is try to unite these forces. They have had success, Martin, with the three non-gravity forces, with the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, and electromagnetism. And they've made some serious headway there. For example, they've been able to unite electromagnetism with the weak nuclear force, and that's called the electroweak force. And so that's a major feather in the cap of physics, modern physics. And they are working on theories that unite the strong nuclear force with the electroweak force, and that looks like they've been working on that. And then, of course, electromagnetism, it was once thought the electric and magnetic forces were separate, but James Clerk Maxwell united them in his Maxwell's theories. So they've made significant progress in the non-gravity forces, but so far they have not been able to unite gravity with the other three non-gravity forces. And so the question is, why not? And here's where it gets really interesting, and this leads to an explanation of the UFO phenomenon, and you'll see why. Okay, here's where it gets very exciting. Gravity, it turns out, the gravity interaction is much, much weaker than the interaction of the other non-gravity forces. And the other forces are relatively close to each other in terms of interaction strength. So, for example, the electromagnetic force compared to gravity is 10 to the 36th power stronger than gravity.
Wow.
And isn't that incredible?
And that's 36 and zeros, words, right?
Exactly right. 36 zeros after the one, one followed by 36 zeros. I mean, it's absolutely staggering. It's I don't even know what they call it, a Googleplex or whatever. And I mean, it's stunning. And the same is true of the other forces of nature. They, too, are tremendously have strong interaction strength compared to gravity. So that appears to be the reason why they can't unite non-gravity forces with gravity, because they can't really get a handle on the quantum aspects of gravity because of its obvious weakness. And in fact, this problem, this discrepancy in strength between the gravitational force and the non-gravity forces is so important in physics and such a big problem that it actually has a name. It's called the hierarchy problem. And so everybody listening should pay attention to that problem in physics, the hierarchy problem, and because that, I also believe, is going to be the key to solving the UFO phenomenon, and we're going to get to that real quick here. And
all right, everyone, thanks so much for listening. That's it for the free part of the show. If you can help us out, we really could use it. We do have expenses, including a new security system that we had to put on our website. Plus, I am paying the show producer every week to bring the show to you, and a lot of other expenses. So if you can help us out, that'd be great, for only $2 or more a month. And that information is on podcastufo.com. Next week, we're going to do an about face from this show. It's going to be on UFOs and owls with Mike McClellan. So kind of the opposite of science. We're going to be talking next week. Mike McClellan is going to be talking about his new book. I want to thank the people that help out with the show, Alejandro Rojas, for the UFO updates. Our guest, of course, Robert Schroeder. Behind the scenes, Evan is the show producer. Peggy helps out with the Facebook page. And Keith over at the Dark Matter Digital Network. Thanks, everyone, and remember to keep your eyes to the sky.